Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Mugwump Tower, this is Albatross 1-3, requesting permission to land. Over.
I don't need a computer to tell me how to land a damn airplane.
Six.
Heads-up display, check.
Five.
Lasers, check.
Four.
Particle beam, check.
Three.
Photon bolts, check.
Two.
Chair control, check.
One.
Let's do it.
Broadcasting from a secret underground location somewhere in Mos Eisley, this is the Docking Bay 77 podcast. Make yourself comfortable. The show is about to start. Hello and welcome to the Docking Bay 77 podcast. I am your host, Dayton Johnson. And, well, hey, it is a new year filled with new adventures, challenges, and opportunities. And with that in mind, welcome to the first in a series of episodes that I am very excited about. Walt Disney Studios is responsible for many well-known movies and characters, but not every movie, is Aladdin, Cinderella, Frozen, or The Jungle Book. In this series of seven episodes over the next 6 months, we will discuss some overlooked and underappreciated animated movies from the Walt Disney Company. So let's get the first episode started, and I'm going to introduce some of my favorite assistant pig keepers. We have the co-host of the Film By podcast, Jeff Johnson. How's it going, Jeff?
Going great, Dayton. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. You as well. And photographer and documentary filmmaker, David Burns. How's it going?
It's going great. Happy New Year.
And comic book nerd and Muppet Ultra fan, Scott Hoffman. How's it going?
Hello there.
All right. So when I put out this call for these episodes, these guys were very excited to jump on this episode. And why? Well, to kick off the series, we're traveling back to a land of magic, swords, a really bad bard, and a special pig. That's right. We're talking about the Black Cauldron.
There once was a spirit so cruel that it was imprisoned forever in the form of a great black cauldron. Now, whoever gets control of the cauldron will rule the world and destroy it. These are our heroes. The ones that will save us. A fearless fighter.
But I'm not afraid. Ouch!
A princess, currently without a throne.
Ouch!
And a lovable pest, Gurgi.
Munchings and crunchings in here somewhere.
But look what our heroes are up against. Moose.
Hmm?
Creeper. A servant of evil. And evil is their leader, the Horned King. And his army of deathless warriors. In 70mm photography and 6-track Dolby sound, Walt Disney Pictures presents The Black Cauldron.
Soon the Black Cauldron will be mine.
Whoa, trouble, goodbye.
The Black Cauldron.
So, let's get some history on the source material, because this is actually based on a series of books, and David Burns, you've got some information for us. What do you got?
I do. So The Black Cauldron is loosely based on the first two books and the Chronicles of Prydaine by the author Lloyd Alexander, a series of five novels that are set in a fantasy world. The five novels take place in Prydaine, a fictional country ruled by a high king who oversees several minor kingdoms. The setting is based on Wales and inhabited by creatures and characters, inspired by Welsh mythology and folklore. The five books are The Book of Three, The Black Cauldron, The Castle of Lear, Terran Wonder, and The High King. So, in doing some of my research on the author, I didn't know much about him. He is an American author born in Philadelphia in 1924. He wrote over 40 books, primarily fantasy novels. He won the 1969 Newbery Medal for Excellence in American Children's Literature. He also won U.S. National Book Awards in 1971 and in 1982. What I find fascinating about him is he taught himself to read around age four. Wow. Which is a little crazy. He did skip a couple grades in school because apparently he was pretty smart. And he ended up deciding that he wanted to go to war because he felt that it was a better, going on an adventure was better school than going to college. So he ended up joining the U.S. Army in World War II. Apparently, he was too clumsy to be in the front lines, and he didn't like the sight of blood. So he ended up going back to Texas, where he had a brief stint in a marching band and then transferred to a chaplain's assistant back in Wales and England. This guy's all over the place. I mean, wow. You can kind of see some of his history on where he like got some of his themes and stuff that he would show in his books. But he would be over 40 years old. He would specialize in children's fantasy novels, which or some of the books that we just talked about. Alex's works are usually coming-of-age novels and fantasy settings. The main characters are common people who return to their regular life after their quests. Lloyd's Alexander, which I thought was fascinating, his reaction to the film, that while it bore little resemblance to his books, he still thought it was a quality story in its own right. He would die May 17, 2007 of cancer, a few weeks later after death of his wife of 61 years.
Wow. I actually did read that recently. Disney did buy the rights to the books again.
Yep.
So hopefully that means they're going to do maybe a series of like maybe Disney Plus series or even a series of movies instead of just one book or one movie.
Yep. I would love that. Let's hope that happens.
Please.
Let that
happen. Yep.
All right. So for those who don't know, Jeff, why don't you tell people what the movie is actually about?
Okay, well, listen, shameless plug here. The three of you were instrumental last year on the 1986 series from A Film By. I always asked you guys to read the back of the box. So with your permission, Dayton, I would love to read the back of the box. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, so I've got my VHS copy here. Disney's 25th full-length animated classic, The Black Cauldron, is a heroic adventure that fills the screen with magic and wonder, overflowing with colorful characters, trailblazing animation, and nonstop action. This critically acclaimed film can now be enjoyed on video for the first time ever. In the mythical land of Perdane, a young boy named Taran, who dreams of a future as an invincible warrior, finds himself leading a real-life quest. In a race against the evil Horned King, Taran must be the first to find the mysterious Black Cauldron, or the Horned King will unleash its power and take over the world. With the help of a magic sword, an enchanting princess, an adorable clairvoyant pig, and a funny little furry creature named Gurgi, Taran overcomes winged dragons, the king's monstrous henchmen, three baddie witches, and more, and learns nothing is as powerful as courage and friendship.
Well said. Well said. Notice how they left the bard out of that story too. So I'm just telling you,
anyway. They did. They left that out.
They mentioned everybody else except for the bard. Poor guy. All right. So Scott has some production history on the movie. What do you got for us?
Yeah. So it's interesting. This is a movie of many milestones for Disney. As Jeff said, this was released on July 24th, 1985 is the 25th animated Disney movie. The first one to be rated PG. The first one to use the new animated opening logo and use closing credits. The first to use some computer generated imagery. And unfortunately, it's also known as the movie that almost killed Disney. So the story was optioned in 1971 and pre-production began back in 73. The story and characters became a little too complex for the studio at the time and it was briefly shelved in 78. When it ramped up in 1980, the animation crew had changed several times from when they were first doing the workup on it. Actually, the original screenwriter also left after several considerable changes were made from the source to the film. The animation crew is a wide kind of collection of animators that were connected to the movie in one way or another, including the iconic Frank and Ollie, and featuring some of the early work of Tim Burton, which we'll get back to in just a second. At one point, apparently Ralph Bakshi was approved to contribute, but he questioned if this movie or his style was an appropriate choice for the Disney audience. And I think he chose wisely, although that would have been an interesting flick.
Yeah.
So during production of The Fox and the Hound, which preceded this movie in 81, animator Don Bluth and roughly 13 other animators left the studio. So this left only a few animators, which was a mix of veterans and a new crew that kind of lacked the experience and the training. And there was a noticeable rift between the old and the new crews. Fast forwarding to when this was finally shown to audiences at test screenings, the kids in the audience found it so intense and disturbing, specifically the Cauldron-born scene, that some ran out of the theater before the movie's end. This includes angry mothers scooping up their kids, and apparently it was a slow trickle that turned into a bit of a wave. So they cut certain scenes in order to make it less scary, which resulted in about 12 or 13 minutes on the cutting room floor, which apparently also includes ideas from Tim Burton about the Horned King using face-hugging creatures to turn people into undead zombies. Again, kind of wish we could see it.
Yes. Me too.
At the time, it was the most expensive animated film ever made, but it was also a bomb. It earned only $21 million versus a $44 million budget, considering that they started back in 71. There's also the investment of time. To add insult to injury, it made so it was beat out by the Care Bears movie.
Yes.
It was released in the same year, which was made for only $2 million. And I think it beat it out by like 23 million or something like that. So not a good time. This hasn't been released on home video, or wasn't released in home video, until 1998. And it's often criticized for story flow and darkness, but is well received for its voice acting and animation.
Yes. All right. Thank you, Scott.
Not going there. Forget the piggy.
What are you doing here?
Going to come back to be your friend.
Friend? You're no friend. Why, you ran away when I... Oh, never mind. I promised Dorben I would keep him safe. I have to go.
All right, so why don't we go with some likes, what we like about the movie. So, Jeff, why don't you go ahead and give us your first like?
All right, hot take here. Not a love. I love this film for the fact that it is... without a single song, no Disney songs, no goofy dance sequences. It's just a great film. And because there's no goofy songs and all that that we're accustomed to nowadays, you get a great score by Elmer Bernstein. That's that's what, first and foremost, that's what I love about the movie.
All right. All right. Scott, something you like?
If I get one thing to like, it's John Hurt as the Horned King.
Yes.
His voice work on this. So obviously the design of the character is a beautiful work of darkness and intrigue. Like, you never see his face. It almost kind of pulls you closer to the screen to see his features at first, but it's that voice that pulls it in over the top. It kind of pulls you in. I noticed after watching this a couple times, he has this low rolling growl that he kind of applies to every single line. It reminds me of other roles that he's in, like the War Doctor and the Storyteller, obviously, but it's a far cry from all those things. You get deep and evil John Hurt. I think it's perfect for the character. It makes me want to know more about the character. Like, was he one of the first Cauldron born, or how is he kind of like the semi-undead kind of guy? Anyway, I know that this gets praised a lot for its voice work, and that's absolutely my standout.
All right. David?
So I'm with Jeff. I love this movie. But it happens later in the film that I absolutely love about this. So when I'm watching this again, to prepare myself for this podcast, I paid really close attention to the character of Taran, because I was like, you know, I really felt like when I watched this a long time ago that he didn't really have a lot of character development. And I'm going to see if that holds true. So as I'm getting through the movie, and I'm like, yeah, this does seem like, you know, Taran's just this, you know, cardboard character. We don't get a lot of emotion from him. We don't get this, you know, this turn of a character that you normally get, you know, from the beginning to the end of a story. But then one thing stood out to me that just caught me by surprise. Like, well, I didn't notice that before. Holy crap. So at the end, after they've beat the Horned King and all that, the witches show up again. And, you know, they basically want the cauldron back. And, you know, they say, well, we'll trade you for something, you know, and obviously he wants the sword back. But when the witches referred to Taran as a hero, he quickly said and responds, Gurgi.
Right.
to me, that added so much to Terrence's character. He did not take any credit whatsoever. He immediately pointed to Gergi. Gergi was the hero. Gergi is the one who should be here with us. And he's the one who sacrificed himself. That right there is like, holy crap. That just proved me how the character development of Taryn right there. That was my biggest love.
All right. That's a good call. It is. I just want to call out the animation in general, considering all the problems they went through. And if you look at the peers at the time, like the Great Mouse Detective and Fox and the Hound and Oliver and Company a few years later, I think the even though they were dealing with a lot of different people in and out and a lot of people that didn't have the experience, I think it's really solid all the way through. I just think it looks good. There's not a lot of, well, I don't buy that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If you, it's like I said, if you, even comparing it to, say, Oliver and Company, I think it's better than that. And that comes years later. So I really love the animation. It looks good. It's solid. And I think that after on these last couple of rewatches, that's the thing that stood out to me the most is by far how good the animation looks for, you know, what was early 80s still.
Mm-hmm. I think just the animation for the Cauldron Born when they're all coming back.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That was fascinating.
I mean, I can see why kids got up and ran because it's mm-hmm. awesome looking, you know, but I'm thinking, what kind of lightweight kids are these that they, that, you know? I mean, why aren't they watching cable like everybody else was when they were kids? That, 'cause I know that's what we were doing.
Right. Well, and I mean, kids at this time, didn't we already have like, this is right before Transformers, the movie.
Yep.
And G.I. Joe, the movie. So we've been seeing kind of, you know, more advanced kind of animation, things that weren't kind of, you know, soft and kind of watered down for kids. And I hate to say it, but Thundercats has the same kind of like, you know, anytime Mumra's on the screen, he's pretty much a Horned King kind of aesthetic. So little kids, probably not too ready for it, but I think the Horned King is a lot scarier than the Cauldron Born. I mean, aside from the, you know, the early scenes that they cut where they would like scratch the henchmen and make them like boil away into, you know, see their flesh melt and whatever. but I mean, they're just like skeleton warriors, right? They're creepy looking, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be like run for your life from the theater. I don't know.
Right. Well, I think kids are probably upset in the theater and you got the angry moms leaving because these aren't the kids that are watching the good Saturday morning cartoons like we were. These are the kids that their parents are like, oh yeah, well, Bambi and Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella. Okay. It's a new
screw
one.
This Let's, thing. We're going to Care Bears.
It's safe. I'm sure they probably weren't even paying attention to the rating because you just assume it's a Disney cartoon. It's fine for your 4-year-old or your 5-year-old. Mm-hmm. And when they got in there, they got the shit scared out of them because the Horned King walked on and, you know, I mean, he's scary now.
Well, let's be fair. It's not like Disney hasn't been dark before. I mean, look at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He was the huntsman was supposed to bring her heart back in a box.
Right.
It's not like we haven't had dark before. You have Maleficent turning into a dragon. I mean, it's not the whole dark thing, you know, it's been there. Mm-hmm. Granted, this kind of pushed the envelope a little bit. And so, yeah, I kind of, you know, I call BS on the whole, oh, it's so dark. I'm like, it is, but it's in the story. It's not like it's dark just to be dark. So anyway,
although there is a really dark thing that I love from the opening where they talk about the guy who was made into the Black Cauldron. Mm-hmm. So not only was he so evil that they tossed him alive into molten metal, but then somebody was like, what do we do with this big vat of, you know, king goo and metal? I know. Let's turn it into a giant pot of evil. Like, damn.
Let's make it one of the ultimate weapons on the world.
Right?
Exactly.
Talk about poor planning, you know, because nobody's ever going to go look for that. Sure, no problem. Anyway, Jeff, any follow-up like you have?
I got to say, it definitely would have been John Huston's opening narration.
Yep, I agree with
Love that.
Yeah.
I mean, it set it up. I almost felt like I was watching Conan the Barbarian. Like I was getting ready for that. Huston is he had such a great voice, you know, tremendous talent, you know, whether he was in front of the screen or behind it. So to snag him and have him do your opening narration kind of set you up for what this awesome cauldron is. Perfect. Loved it.
Barry?
I wasn't afraid.
Ouch.
not afraid? Why, we were running for our lives.
Well, I got us out of the castle, didn't I?
Phew. I'd say it was the sword's magic.
But it takes a great warrior to handle a sword like this.
But still, it is a magic sword.
Huh. What does a girl know about swords anyway?
Girl? Girl? If it weren't for this girl, you would still be in the Horned King's dungeon.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and move on to a couple of dislikes. Jeff, why don't you go ahead and give us your first?
All right, I'm going to nitpick here because I love the movie. But if I had one thing that I was like, I wish they could have changed it a little bit, would probably be the overall personality or design of Gurgi. Because, and I know Scott's probably with me on this, he's basically Gollum with a little bit of snarf from Thundercats.
Yeah, it's Hair Club for Gollum. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he is Gollum. He's flat out. I challenge anyone to say he's not Gollum.
He's an ounce of phlegm away from being Andy Serkis. Well, he adopts this guy that he calls Master all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The guy that is an unlikely hero who starts a quest to keep a magical item from an evil ruler.
Yeah.
That needs to destroy a magic item before evil is returning.
Speaks in rhyme, you know.
Okay, right. So
you leave Gurney alone, okay?
Hold on. You asked me for my dislike. I'm giving the dislike.
Okay, that's fair, but I'd much rather hang out with Gurgi than Gollum. Sorry, I'm not afraid Gurgi's going to try and murder me in the middle of the night. So
the question wasn't who do I want to hang out with. What did I dislike? I just disliked fair. That Gurgi's.
What Nintendo game
similar.
Are you playing?
All right. Scott, dislike.
Princess Ilanwe.
Ilanwe.
There you go.
Really? Actually, I really liked her. Really?
Yeah.
I'm disappointed by the way that she's introduced. Because when I first saw her, I assumed that it was going to be, because I had forgotten about this movie, like the intricacies of it.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that she was the Horned King in disguise.
Okay.
So I kind of thought, like, he's locked up in this dungeon that conveniently has this really easy to open hatch in the floor. And then she's like, oh, all right, well, let's get out of here. Like, it's that easy. And they just go traipsing out of the castle. So it just seemed like her, I don't know. I had a really hard time figuring out what her role is in the whole thing. And I know it's to kind of help Taryn grow a little bit as a character and whatnot, but it just seemed like really disjointed. You lose her bauble thing like halfway through the movie. I don't know. There's just a lot of stuff related to her that I was just like, I don't get it.
Can I challenge that?
You go right ahead, because I was going to do it too.
Okay.
Give me just a minute to say you're wrong, Scott. And go.
I dig the fact that she's not the classic damsel in distress.
Yeah.
She states that she has been there. You know, the Horned King took her because, you know, he thought that she would be useful in obtaining the Black Cauldron. Right. So she's been working her way out of this terror castle, you know, and she's been trying to figure out an escape. And they don't traipse out of there. It's like it's a giant battle to get out of there. So... I don't know, man. I don't agree with anything you just said.
Thinking back, they don't have to unlock anything. They don't have to really struggle to get out of there. They get some axes thrown at them and whatnot. But like, there's one scene where they're running across this bridge, and all of a sudden he stops. She keeps running, and he gets distracted and just starts playing with the sword. And I'm like, do you remember that you guys are supposed to get out of the castle?
How is that her fault?
What are you talking about?
Yeah. I said first it's related. Off, it's related right, to
right. Yeah, but okay. He dropped the sword. He's not gonna leave that, especially after that Conan moment where he found it on top of the crypt.
True.
That's straight out of Conan the Barbarian. So he's not gonna anger Crom by just dropping it and leaving it there. He's gonna jump down and grab it. And he had to hide from the henchmen. And she's not gonna stop and wait for him. She's all about getting out of there. So
yeah,
I disagree with you again.
All right,
I'm sorry. I look at her as the brains of the group, to be really honest.
Yes.
Oh, true. Yeah,
she's the brains.
I can see that, all of them for sure.
Yeah, she's by far the brains. So
it's a low bar. So
well, that's sorry. That's not wrong. But she's still the brains of the group. So there you go. All right.
I mean,
sorry, Scott. We award you no points.
when the main hero, his only weapons are courage and pluck and pleading, like his, he doesn't even do anything with the sword. The sword does it all on its own. It's like a dragon's lair sword. That's just kind of like, has its own theme music, just floats in the air and slashes pots and skillets. And he's just like, oh, look,
I quote Taryn, hey, I had to wield the sword. So
great.
Sword's just laying there with, until he picks it up.
That's right.
He brings it back to life.
He's the most impressive caddy I've ever seen.
Man, Scott.
No, well, see, you know what? Man. But you know what? He's not wrong. All right, David, something you don't like.
Jeez, I'm not going to go like that with Scott, man. my biggest dislike, I think, is the besides the narration at the beginning, I thought right after that was really slow opening. To me, you know, you got to grab your audience within the first 10 minutes, and I felt like it was a little slow. And when I did a little research to find out, I wish we'd gotten a little bit more of the opening that they had conceptualized before, which I'm sure was cut out because, you know, Disney was freaking out already. But apparently there's a version, well, not a version, but they had started talking about it where the Horned King and his gang were burning down villages and like sweeping flames were used as transitions between scenes of destruction. And, you know, and then it transient and goes into, which basically contrasts the piece and all of that, like within the first 10 minutes of the film. I felt like if we had opened up with that, that would have pulled me in quicker than it. I mean, I still did get pulled in eventually because I love this movie, but I felt like that would have been a better opening in the first 10 minutes.
Well, especially considering that scene where they kind of show Creeper kind of guiding that big trolley in. With all the dead bodies on it.
Right.
Yeah.
He's basically making his own corpse army.
Yep.
Right. Right. Okay. So my biggest dislike, apart from Taryn ruining one job he had in like 10 seconds after he, don't lose the pig. What? Where'd the pig go? Anyway, there is, and Dave actually kind of mentioned it a little bit, there's really no character development for any of our characters at all.
Right.
And I mean, Taryn's just like, yeah, I want to be a fighter. And, you know, it, and okay, great. And that's about it. And he has that one moment at the end of the movie. Yes. But why is he on the farm? Who is the relationship to this? Why is he there? And then we don't get anything about the princess, except, like I said, she's the brains, but you know, where's her kingdom looking for her? What happened to her kingdom? You know, and why would the bard ever show up on the front step of that friggin' castle that looks so much like the Dark Crystal castle to me. That's another thing. But it's like there's no development. And they had opportunities to do that, had conversations they could have had, and they just didn't do it. I mean, the movie, even with the stuff they cut out, you know, is 80 minutes long. That is super short.
Mm-hmm.
So let, you know, a couple minutes here, a couple minutes there of character development would have been very nice. Otherwise, we're literally just watching people going through the motions of, you know, of an adventure that isn't quite an adventure. You know, it's so my biggest complaint is there's like zero attempt to get us to like, you know, or understand these characters and what they're trying to do, except for finding the cauldron.
Mm-hmm.
So
while Scott catches his breath, can I challenge you for a minute now?
You go right ahead. You can be wrong all day long.
Oh,
look, you know, you talk about character development. I feel like anyone involved on this project, clearly they had to be a student of Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces. Cause this is that classic monomyth where you've got the young person who's never been on an adventure, never had life experience, wants to be a great warrior, a great fighter, whatever, you know, goes on this grand adventure, learns something about themselves at the end of it. I feel like Taryn had a good amount of development because the whole time he's, you know, he's all about being on this quest and being a hero and a great warrior. And it's even Princess Ilanwe who even says, you never stop talking about it. You know, she even calls out his egotism, but
yep,
it's at the end. Dave mentioned one of his favorite moments when the witches bargain, you know, they want the sword. And he says, you know, no, you can have the sword, but I want Gergi. He's the real hero. I feel like he learned about himself. And Gergi also, Gergi runs through the whole movie as a coward. He's Taran never takes a moment not to call him a coward. And anytime the bad guys show up, he's like, all right, I'm out of here. But when push comes to shove and someone has to sacrifice themselves, Gergi has that heartbreaking moment where he says, you know, you've got lots of friends. I don't have any. And he sacrifices himself. He jumps in, he makes that 40-foot dive into the cauldron.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that's great character development for him too, even though he's a furry golem. Golem. You know. Now, so, as for the bard and everyone else, I agree.
So wait, not a whole lot. So you're saying the character development happens at the very end of the movie. Okay, as opposed to developing the character as we're learning about them throughout the course of the movie. So when they die,
I'm saying that the
characters, that's more like a punctuation mark, isn't it?
Okay, well, I'm saying a false hero, a false warrior, if you will, learned to be humble.
Yep.
By the end of the movie, a coward learned to be courageous.
All right.
And care for people by the end of the movie. So yeah, I say you're wrong all day on this one.
So I got a question related to the whole bringing Gergi back. Does that reactivate the cauldron?
Oh, geez.
No, I mean, come on. Somebody has to sacrifice themselves. And I mean, sacrifice is undone. I know that doesn't bring back the Horned King because it's like, oh, for God's sake.
I mean, I'm more concerned with a pet cemetery situation because I don't know what he's going to be like when he comes back to life. He was dead, so
he's going
to
go full Gage on him,
right?
Yeah, Gergi, he could be Gagey, you know. Right? I don't know.
Gagey.
Sometimes dead is better.
Nice. Okay.
Now I call on my army of the dead. The cauldron. Arise, my messengers of death. Our time has arrived.
All right, let's move on to some favorite scenes. All right, we'll start with Dave first this time. You have a favorite scene?
And I've already mentioned this before, but I guess not really. I think the Cauldronborn is probably one of my favorite scenes of the whole thing. But I have to say the Horned King being killed is the best.
All right.
Yep.
Scott,
I'll say the Cauldronborn scene. It's obviously got great animation, and there's that mm-hmm. weird kind of like doubling effect that I saw when you see that march of the skeleton warriors, but it does make me kind of wonder what powers the Horned King really had.
Yeah,
because aside from having amazing grip strength, he doesn't do like a I lot said of magic
character things. Development
right.
We don't know where he came from or what his deal is. He's just there.
So I thought that was really well designed, really well done. It kind of pays off all the menace that they, you know, mm-hmm. start to kind of build in this or start to promise with just his look. So I thought it was great. I think that could have been a little bit more, but.
Well, there was. They cut it all out.
Yeah. I
know. All right. Jeff, favorite scene?
Probably the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. the Cauldronborn scene. Look, I don't care who you are. If you're a fan of Raiders, you gotta see it. The Black Cauldron is like the anti-Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
Right with the creepy green mist flowing out of it and the Army of the Dead. It's almost the same thing. Like, you know, Taran found it, the bad guys get it, you know, Indy finds it, the Nazis get it. No, I love the moment though. I can totally understand why in 1985 there were Karens snatching up their 4-year-olds and dragging them out of the theater when he's saying stuff like "Arise, my messengers of death," you mm-hmm. know, "Go forth and conquer. It's our time."
It's so that metal.
Is some heavy Disney
yeah,
so dialogue. So
just awesome,
that whole
though.
Scene's awesome. It's the best scene of the movie. Dane, yeah. is it your go-to scene?
Well, since everybody else said the Cauldronborn, I'm actually going with the when they escape from the castle. because I thought there was a lot of good stuff going on in there.
Yes.
Some decent action sequences. You know, you have a cool sword. You know, there's some sneaking. There's some, you know, some bravery, some problem solving. So, yeah, I really like the Escape from the Castle.
Great, great one, too.
Yeah. Yep. Did anybody else notice the Dragon's Lair theme music that was going on whenever the sword would swing?
Anyone did, it had to be Dayton.
Okay, so here's the thing. Don't get me talking about the score, because I really don't want to get in trouble. Okay. So
all right.
I am not a fan of Bernstein, because every time I hear any of his pieces of music, I think of Stripes. It doesn't matter what movie it's in. because I hear that, you know, that one thing that, dun, 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 you know, I just heard the same piece of music from Stripes, and I always hear little bits of it in a lot of his other work. So it just throws me off completely. So it's on me, you know, Oscar winner, I know, whatever. Every time I hear a piece of his music, that's what I hear. So I'm broken. It's fine. Right. So no, I didn't pick up on that because the Dragon's Lair game was awesome, but I was so bad at it after $20 worth, I just stopped playing it ever again. So
yeah, same here, Dayton. I was terrible at it. Terrible.
So bad. I wanted to love it, but I was like,
was anyone good at it? Really?
I mean, I sat and watched the guy for almost an hour in an arcade one day beat the damn game, and I'm like, okay, fine.
Apparently, how many '80s dollars did that guy drop? Because it was dollars to pay. Play that.
I know it was. I know. Well, when you don't die every time you touch the joystick like I did, you got to, you know, yeah, farther than so it was cool.
I remember playing that in Aladdin's Castle. You guys remember that place?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
You shall all be turned into frogs and eaten. Nice and tender. Stop that, you. You.
Oh, so nice to meet you, ladies. Goodbye.
Wait. My. Aren't you the handsome one?
Who, me?
Oh, honestly now, don't you find me irresistible?
Yes, well, of course, Mr. Shush, stop that.
You don't mind if I pluck your harp? Do you handsome?
All right. So Jeff, favorite character?
Absolutely, the Horned King. He's everything a Disney villain should be. I mean, he's, whether you want to say he's Skeletor's disapproving father or he's just bad to be bad, he is so menacing and creepy. Hurt's voice really takes it to another level. And I don't know if you guys read any of the books, but I wanted to know more about him. So when I was doing some research, my understanding is that he's kind of like two different characters from the books kind of combined. And there's a greater evil in the book. And this guy was kind of like the second in command. So, you know, again, if they ever do anything more like a Disney Plus series or a series of movies, I would love to see him, you know, no pun intended, fleshed out a little bit more, because nice. He is an awesome character. Scary.
So do you prefer him with or without the red eyes that he gets at the end?
I think the red eyes distract me. Yeah. Without. I don't like the red eyes.
Without. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
When the red eyes pop out at the end, it kind of reminded me of when Cruella got a little crazy at the end of 101 Dalmatians.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll say,
I can see
you
that.
Know, yep. And not that that's a bad thing, but I just, up until that moment, he was, you could almost see the Horned King in like the animated film Heavy Metal. Like he's,
yes.
He's just, he does it. There's nothing Disney about him. So I'll go without the red eyes.
Mm. All right. Scott, favorite character.
I'm going to go with Creeper, played by 86 Phenom, Phil Fondacaro.
Yes.
I think he's one of the most Disney characters in there. So I think he has the kind of Disney bounce that makes it entertaining. The quality and distinctiveness of Phil's voice, I think make this character worth noticing from the get-go, but he's got more character and personality than most of the other main characters. And it clearly sounds like Phil is having fun in the booth when he's recording it. Mm-hmm. So I was just glad to hear that.
All right, David.
I'm going to agree 110% with Jeff when we talk about the Horned King. The dude is just dark and menacing, and just his slow sauntering around his castle, not in a hurry for anything, because, you know, he's the Horn King. Who else is going to do anything to him, you know? So, yeah, Horn King for sure.
All right. So mine might be a little out of left field, and that's cool. I'm actually choosing the witches because they're a lot of fun. They crack me up. They're well-voiced. And if you look at them, they're literally the kind of the prototypes for the Hocus Pocus witches we got in the early 90s. And if you look at the Fates in Hercules, very similar as well, you know, as far as their behaviors and their way they interact with each other. So they're just fun. And they actually serve a pretty decent purpose in the movie as well. So
that's Dayton, I got a question. Maybe you can answer the three witches that like that archetype. You know, I always think like the first time I noticed that was probably the Stygian witches in Clash of the Titans.
Right.
Where did the three witches come from? Like, do you happen to know, like, what the first appearance of this set of characters was? Maybe Shakespeare?
It could be Shakespeare, but it
that would make sense because it was Hamlet.
Yeah.
Because he comes across the witches. So that would make the most sense to me.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Love those characters, though. Good choice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good choice.
Definitely see where we got the PG element too with
with the frog scene.
Frog scene.
Yeah.
Hello. It's like, yeah, I don't know. He was having, if I'm that frog, I'm having a great time.
Yeah. Some Disney exec walks in and they're like, "You're still animating this scene? How long is this scene going to go?"
It's got to look good. Yep. Anyway. All right. So Jeff, favorite fantastical creature.
Without a doubt, gotta be Dolly of the Fair Folk.
Okay.
I love that little dude. he is clearly the brains, the muscle, and the maintenance of that whole world. That king, who is it? King Italoweg or
yeah, something
I'm
like that.
I'm saying it wrong.
These names are not easy to say. They're really not
easy to say, but every question that king gets, he's like, Dolly, can you? You know, and I love the fact that Dolly's like, is that my job now too? Like, now I got to do that.
Right?
He's the Dante of the Fair Folk.
He is. And I love him. I thought he was a great addition to their band of characters. You know, when it's like, well, find the castle or how do we get to the cauldron and all that? Well, Dolly will show you. Okay. Right? That's my job too now. Yeah. I'm supposed to be here today. Yeah,
right.
Clearly see him doing that. Yeah. Love Dolly. He's fantastic.
All right. Scott.
I've got to go with the Maleficent twins. Those two dragons.
Yes.
Mm. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great design. I feel like it pulls in a little bit more of the Bald Mountain aesthetic, that just adds a little bit of menace to the Horn King. Aside from bossing around a bunch of barbarian morons and creeper, clearly he's got to be pretty badass to be able to, you know, leash those two things.
Right. All right, David.
Gurgi came back to be your friend. I'm sorry. As much as the hatred is here on Gurgi, I love Gurgi. You know, I do see what Jeff and Scott are saying, but yeah, I love his character. I thought he brought a fun element to Taryn's character and being the coward that he was and his turn and his sacrifice. I have to go with Gurgi.
Right. That's fair. All right. I'm going with the dragons, you know, his pets, because those were pretty awesome. And they actually, you know, were pretty good. You know, most of the other people he had working for him seemed to be idiots. So that you can count on the dragons. So, all right. I have a couple surprise questions for you gentlemen. Buckle up for this one. Okay. So as we've talked about, the Horn King is quite frightening, but we've also mentioned that he's not the first of the frightening Disney villains. So here are your choices. From Sleeping Beauty, you have Maleficent's dragon. From Snow White, you have the Evil Queen in hag form. Of course, Jafar as the snake, Hades, and the Horned King. Who is actually the most frightening? Jeff.
I still got to go with the Horned King because I love all those villains that you just mentioned, but none of them have such a terrifying look as he does. He says a lot with just his look. So I'm going to go that one.
Horned All King. Right. Scott?
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Horn King. Like, I was kind of mulling over, like, the witch in Snow White has that transformation scene that's fantastic. And obviously the Maleficent dragon is very imposing. Hades probably has the most power of all of them. But Horned King is just one where every time I would watch this, I would kind of pause when you see him come on screen, because like Dave was saying, you have that like slow walk and the features that never kind of reveal unless you really look kind of close at the screen. I don't know. He's just got the best presence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. David?
I'm going to go with the trifecta here. I have to go with the Horned King. I mean, that slow walk, he's like a serial killer. I mean, come on. He's like Michael Myers, you know? This is his world. You know, he's in no hurry for anybody. Come on. It's the Horned King.
All right. That's fair. Okay. So Disney has actually ventured into the sword and sandals genre quite a few times, including Robin Hood, Sword in the Stone, Hercules, of course, the Black Cauldron, and recently Pixar did it with Onward. Out of these five, which one does sword and sorcery and sandals the best? Jeff?
I'm going to go with my favorite Disney film, animated film, and that's Black Cauldron.
All right. Wow. Okay. All right. Scott?
I'd actually go Hercules.
Mm. All right. Good call. All right.
I think it has more of a range of, you know, mythical characters, and obviously, you know, sword and sandals, it's got that nailed down. It has the music. So sorry, Jeff. but it's got Cerberus. It's got the Hydra. It's even got Hercules kind of bending the sword into a boomerang and tossing it around, which is goofy as hell, but I still love it.
Yep.
All right, David.
Without a doubt, the Black Cauldron.
All right. Now I have a question. Have you guys all seen Onward?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Right, no. Good. Oh, Jeff, you need to check it out.
It's in my queue.
It's so good.
It looks good. I want to see it. I love the talent that's involved. So I plan to watch it soon.
Yeah. And in preparation for this, I rewatched Sword in the Stone and Onward again. So, and Onward just keeps getting better every time I watch it. So, okay. So now another question, this could be really interesting. Who would you rather have as your henchman and or sidekick, Gurgi or Creeper? Jeff?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I know.
You picked on Gurgi. Get out of here.
To clarify, I didn't really pick on him. I took issue with his design, his character design. If I have one as a henchman, I got to go Creeper because, you know, he's a sycophant. I mean, he'll do anything I need.
He might just, not do it well, but he'll do it.
Maybe not well, but... You know, he will charge forth just to put a smile on my bony skeleton face. So I'm going Creeper.
All right. Scott.
I'm on a flip and go Gurgi. Because to counter what Jeff was just saying, Creeper is marching up the stairs and he's like, oh God, what am I gonna tell him? Well, I'll tell you what I'll tell him. I'll tell him to stick it where the sun don't shine. Yeah, that's what I'm gonna do. Then he buckles like a belt and strangles himself. But then when he's flying away, celebrating the Horned King by like holding up his severed appendages on the side of his head and going bananas, I don't think that's the guy that I want to have my back. So I'm gonna give him munchies and crunchies, and Gurgi's my guy.
All right, David.
So two answers here. I'm going to pull Scott Hoffman.
Yes, trademark.
So if it's pre-sacrifice of Gurgi, I'm going to go with Creeper. If it's after sacrifice Gurgi, I'm going with Gurgi. Because that's where he turns for his character. And Gurgi is very, very, would be very, very loyal. And he's not a coward anymore. So I would go with him. But yeah, that's my answer.
That is such a Scott Hoffman answer. That's very good.
It's the best of both worlds.
Right.
If I could turn any of these guys, Dayton, I will say that in a leadership mode, you should always be about developing those that work for you. And Creeper taking off on the end on one of them dragons, like he clearly has ambition. He's going to step up. Creeper is promotable in my organization, as far as I'm concerned.
I think he's going to find another, you know, evil leader to, you know, suck up to. That's what I'm thinking. So
I'm sure.
All right. So before we move on to our ratings, let's take a quick break and hear from our friends at Vintage Video.
On the Vintage Video Podcast, we'll be reviewing every single wide release of the 1980s in chronological order. Over 250 episodes to enjoy and thousands more to come. John enters the store now to order another can of ether. I picture him outside like Homer with the gasohol.
One for you, one for me.
I also like to think about that the kids renew their vow not to talk about the murder
by murdering someone.
They're taking a blood oath with someone else's blood.
This stuff is 7 times more powerful than uranium. And they open up the vault that it's contained in, not wearing any kind of protective gear. Yeah.
And it's wooden crates.
Wooden crates. It's like the guys in Chernobyl picking up the graphite rocks and going, meh, because there's rocks.
Hugging the elephant foot. Just like, oh, this thing's smooth.
It's so warm.
He turns to dial the number from the classified ad without even thinking about the numbers. We know this because we can hear his thoughts, and he's talking about how AJ was right that ninjas are misdirecting him.
They're misdirecting him.
I really wish that he'd turned to the phone and been like, 6, 6, 5, 5.
That's 2, 5, 2, 5.
Vintage Video. We're rewatching the 80s, so you don't have to.
Okay, so we are back, and we're going to get ready to do our ratings. In case you have not seen this movie or haven't seen it in years, it is currently streaming on Disney Plus in a nice 4K version. It is also available on DVD and Blu-ray. And there is a Blu-ray version that was released through Disney's Movie Club that can be bought on Amazon. I did find it on there. It is not cheap because it was limited, but it is available on there. So, all right. So our rating choices are Never Again, Stream It, Buy It Used, Buy It New, or the 4K Blu-ray. So I'm pretty sure I know Jeff's answer. Jeff, what do you give it?
Well, I would be curious to see what's included on that Blu-ray edition you mentioned, because the 4K streaming option on Disney looks gorgeous. That's how I watched it again. But man, if they put out a 4K version that had like the cut footage, I'd buy it in a second.
All right. Scott.
I'd be inclined to say stream it. Because if streaming watches help them to see any kind of interest in the property, which clearly we've all spiked it a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
If that pulls them any closer to turning it into some kind of series, I think that'd be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. All right. David?
I'm with you, Dayton. Physical copy is the best. And so I'm going to say you need to get a copy of this, and this needs to be in your collection. But I would agree a little bit with Scott on that one too, because they need to see, but then sales would do it too. So I mean, if you're buying the movie, they're going to see that it's selling. But yes, I want a live action of the Black Cauldron, and I want it done with the 5 books correctly. That's what I want.
Right.
Interesting.
All right. I'm going to say buy it used, because I don't love it like a few of you. I do like it, and I do have a copy of it in my collection. It just has some issues. And as far as the overall feel, I think, you know, somewhere in the middle, buy it used is what I'm going to give it. So,
Dayton, quick question for you.
Yes.
So I know you said you're going to tackle a couple of these underrated Disney classics.
Yes.
At the end, are we going to hear what your go-to, your favorite Disney classic is? Or are you going to hold that to the end? Or can you tell us now? Can you hint at it? What do you got for us?
Excuse me, of the underrated ones?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll save that. That's a very good question. I will save that. And I can tell you, of the ones we are covering, there is one that completely stands out. So yes.
Cool. Okay. I look forward to that answer.
So actually what I'll do at the end, I'll put them all in order. How about that? There's 7 movies, better. I'll do my top 7 of the ones we covered. How about that?
Nice.
All right.
Nice.
Even better.
All right. Very good. Okay. So David and Scott, you guys have something coming up. What is that all about?
Sure do. Scott?
Yeah. So we have a series coming up. It's a limited series on the A Film By podcast called A Film at 45. So we're dusting off the end of a decade that changed cinema forever with a fresh look at modern classics and hidden gems that we can't stop watching. That's going to include some animated classics from 78, such as Watership Down and Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings in future episodes, which has an interesting connection to our first episode, which will be about Greece.
Nice. Very cool. All right. Jeff, what's coming up on A Film By?
Next week, we will be talking about a director that you guys covered at the end of last year, talking about Terry Gilliam. And we're going to be talking about one of our favorite films of his, 12 Monkeys.
Very nice. What a very cool movie. All right. So listeners, reach on out to us and let us know what you think about this one. If you've checked out The Black Cauldron or if you're looking forward to checking it out, reach out to us on social media, Docking Bay 77 Podcast on Facebook, Docking Bay 77 Pod on Twitter, and Docking Bay 77 Podcast at gmail.com. You can also go to Patreon, and for as little as $1 a month, help offset the cost of the production of this podcast. So, gentlemen, thank you once again for stopping by and talking movies with me. It is always a pleasure. So thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Always happy to be here.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Dayton. Always a pleasure, man.
All right. Come back next week. I'm excited about this one because this one, hopefully a couple movies that people, if they haven't seen, they definitely need to check out. We are comparing and contrasting two family fighting movies of a sort. We are discussing Warrior versus The Fighter. And it is January, and as far as I'm concerned, after Christmas, winter is one big ball of gray suck. So I'm looking forward to spring, very much looking forward to April. And you can actually come visit me in Lexington, Kentucky, April 21st, 22nd, and 23rd at Lexicon, a board game and RPG convention. And you come out and hang out with me and Disney John, and we are going to be displaying and playing a prototype of a board game that we've been working on with some other friends of the podcast. So do yourself a favor, watch more movies. And remember, physical media is better than streaming. The Docking Bay 77 podcast is produced and edited by Dayton Johnson, recorded with Rode Pod mics, the Zoom PodTrack P4, and edited on Audacity. Opening music provided by Eric Jason Brock. You can find him on YouTube and Bandcamp. Thank you for listening.